am I to complain? I at least in my 6 years now where I'm independent, I never was in real money trouble. So
where has your funding come from?
I had funding from Pew, from NIH, from the American Cancer Society, from a small private foundation. What's its name? I will tell you. Herschel. It's somewhere on my CV.
Norman and Rosita Winston Foundation. Or is it?
It's Herschel. That's the one now. The Rosita Winston Foundation I had as a poster.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And so the Herschel Wild Collier,
right,
medical scholar is also a defined period of time.
5 years.
Yeah. Is that a local foundation?
That is a foundation which gives one slot per year to Rockefeller, Sloan Kettering, Cornell, Einstein, Columbia, NYU.
Yeah, okay.
It's a sort of middle career award, you know.
Okay, one question I have is, oh, I'll get asked this because it's on the top of my mind. This week, Tuesday, I guess, the New York Times reported, and it's been reported before, that New York City, which has received a lion's share of federal funding in recent years, has dropped significantly, and that this 10-institution kind of New York consortium has been created in order to address that problem and reestablish the funding levels. That includes NYU and Cold Spring Harbor and Cornell and Kettering and Rockefeller. So how do you account for this supposed problem in New York City in getting federal funding?
You know, on a personal level, I cannot account for it. I do not experience it.
So Cornell has not gathered its PIs around it and said we need to create this larger institutional infrastructure in order to, you know...
Look, essentially what happened was that... no, this did not happen. Look, in my micro-environment, I really have to say that the chair here of the department, Lorraine Goodas, she became chair of pharmacology in 91, did really an excellent job. All the young people she hired had no difficulty in getting money, and most of them are good and are really good scientists, good people. So personally, I do not feel the pressure.
Okay. And what difference does it make whether charitable organizations like the Pew Charitable Trust or the Herschel Weil or the Norman and Rosita Winston Foundation funds your science versus a nonprofit agency with specific goals like the American Cancer Society versus federal or public sources of funding? What difference does it make where that funding is coming from or what difference does it make to the kind of science, the kind of questions, the kind of experiments you propose?
Okay. Look, Pew in a way was a dream, because what happened was that we were money given to do whatever we want to with it, and the more creative the better. This was this is in a way what you want. However, look, moment the money is in the pot, nobody cares what you do with it. And clear cut, the university is interested to get as much NIH money as possible, because the indirect costs they get from NIH are way higher than what they get from other sources. So we have a certain pressure to go for NIH grants. And for NIH grants are restricted. And look, I like to have some money on the side to which I have non-restricted access. What I do not have with the NIH money. So, for example, for me in the moment, it's very good to have this Herschel money, even if it's only $20,000 per year. But I can do with that, as I did today, simply say, let's buy a computer with that, because the computer broke, you know. With NIH money, it's not so easy. So I really need both sorts of money. I need NIH money due to pressures from the university, and I additionally need for myself at least one other source of money which I can use for whatever is happening on a day-to-day level. Yeah.
And what kind of opportunities are there to search out these kind of no strings attached funds?
The good ones are the ones where, similar to Pew or to Herschel, where simply the university has to propose people, and then it's going through a screening system, and yeah, it's. I like this sort of applications, because really these are the applications where I can write whatever I want.
Yeah.
The non-restricted ones here, I do not hide anything.
Well, Pew's no longer an option, one, because you've already had it, and two, you're kind of this middle-aged.
Right.
PI.
Look, now, I simply have to look. Now I have Herschel. When Herschel runs out, a year before, I have to think, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Time yet.
Yeah. So, perhaps I'm a little bit naive here, you know. I'm simply living a little bit from year to year.
So you aren't waking up at 3 in the morning figuring out how you can get a Howard Hughes?
No, definitely not. It happens or it does not happen, and not even,
is that something you'd want?
What is? Do I want Hughes? I'm not sure. I experienced an ex-Hughes and saw the difficulties he had after Hughes did not fund him anymore. It's nasty, because he had incredible difficulties afterwards to get NIH funding back. Mm-hmm. Look, it's the same, it's a little bit the same situation as 5 years ago, or let's say 10 years ago, my dream would have been to be a primary investigator at one of the Hoffman La Roche institutes.
Mm-hmm.
Because, look, this would mean you are a PI in a surrounding where you do not have to look for money. And excellent science was done there. But then from one day to the next, you were told in 6 months the institute will close. And now these middle-level guys had incredible difficulties. They were at their mid-stage careers, had labs of 8 people, had spent 10 years as PIs, and never got 1 cent of outside funding. They had difficulties of getting positions. They had difficulties of years where they needed to reestablish funding. And so luckily, I did not go for something like that. So, on one side, a youth position would be a great thing. Oh, it would be good. Okay. But
why?
I'm not hustling for that.
Yeah.
It's nothing which I'm,
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, given it seems to me like there's these two kind of pots of money. There is the NIH pot of money that it funds boring, somewhat boring.
Oh, and shall I wait? Okay. In the moment, I do not want use.
Okay.
And I tell you why. Because I only would like to get use if Lani would get it at the same time. Because otherwise our relationship would become unequal, and that would, I would not like that. So, yeah, this is, in the moment, I would not like to have use. Or together with Lani, then it's fine.
Yeah, okay. And in terms of what kind of money this would be, what kind of money does Howard Hughes Medical Institute money mean?
You know, in... The thing is, I see in this case Howard Institute money, not the money value. I, in the moment, have enough money for my lab. I always had enough money for my lab. The good thing would be a little bit more of prestige in getting good postdoc applicants. That would be the one positive side.
And how much money is enough, or how much funding is enough
for me?
Your lab?
Okay. I also have to say the following: I do not want to work in a huge lab.
Okay.
I myself want to work at least 40% of my time. I want to work with my own hands and work on my own project. And the way I had it for the last years and the way I still want to have it in the next years is that the grad students and postdocs in my lab are doing the mainstream research of the lab, doing, let's say, characterizing the enzymes in the retroretinoid field, which really will be a major effort in the next years in the lab. And however, I for myself want to go on as I did for the last 6-7 years, follow ideas which could be in this context, which could be totally independent of it, and work with my own hands, like purifying soluble cyclase, like purifying with postdoc then in Ron Evans' lab, a new retinoid. Like, you know, and if my lab is too big, then it would be too much administrative work, and then I could not do that. And I think that... my lab would, or I would lose, I do not want to lose that, yeah. So, essentially, long-term, my lab can survive well on 2 R01s and something additional, yeah. And size-wise, together with Lani, I would like to have a lab of perhaps, this Lani and me, 12 people, and good people. I think it's better to have 3 good people than 10 workers. Yeah. We are not doing the Human Genome Project. Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that you're describing like two kind of opportunities for funding. The NIH type, which is federal money that's funding somewhat boring science, but is important for you because your institution wants that kind for its own...
Right.
For
right.
The funding is for money coming into it for its own reasons. And then there's the second kind of opportunities for funding that come from private organizations that is basically no strings attached, but is essentially smaller, very small
in
comparison. So what kind of changes do you think should or can be made to create the best possible funding system? for biomedical research?
Oh. You know, what would I change? In applications, what I would change, I would give money more for not on a proposal, but more on what people already did, you know, and what they showed that what they are able to do, more than on I do not have good answers here. I do not have them. I also do not want to criticize NIH, the funding mechanisms as they are in the moment, because I would not know how to do it better. I do not have a valuable alternative.
Yeah.
Nah, I do not have.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess this is a matter. You had talked about yesterday that really, you know, to do the best creative science, scientists need to be. They need to be able to play.
Right.
And at what point should scientists become concerned enough, and you know, you specifically be concerned enough about funding mechanisms and the implications it has for science and the kind of science that's been done to start thinking about alternatives? Or do you see the situation, you know, is that, you know, that maybe looking at the situation as very dire? Or as opposed to, as long as you've been able to get enough money to play, then the system isn't broke? I guess to switch directions again, when you originally came to the United States, your intentions were to do your 2 years of postdoc, get the techniques you needed to do, and go back to Tübingen, perhaps, finish into your residency.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened to that? Why do you stay in the United States? Why do you not return to finish your residency?
Okay. Look, what happened was that during the work in Hammerling's lab, I became really interested in this project. I wanted to finish it, and one step led to the next, that it was suddenly clear after 4 years that I do not want to go back to clinics. I want to go on. I became more and more fascinated in basic biology, and say to you, there was a conscious decision. No, there was not.
Okay.
Suddenly it was clear, I want to go on this basic academic research and I never had any bad feelings about that. Look, even with the knowledge that I do not have comparable amounts of money and stuff like that, but the thing I really like in basic research that essentially I can do whatever I want, and I have this freedom of I can work today. I really have freedoms I would not have in a clinical surrounding, and I like them.
Okay.
Yeah. And also, look, in the beginning I thought I should do transitional research because I'm coming from this medical background, but to be honest today, I'm as interested in what's happening in yeast as I'm interested in what's happening in human tumor. And the fascinating story is that from other model systems, we often can learn a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you what happened to this interest that what you thought is trans. And is an issue of what you thought was translational research at the time, taking the cells from a patient and to the bench.
But look,
is there still clinical relevance to your work, or is that even an issue anymore?
You know, the hopes which we had a little bit naively in the early 70s did not work out. I mean, the science stuff that we could use cells, could predict then these cells respond against this sort of chemotherapy, it did not work out. And look, what I also had a little bit this idea then of, let's say we treat a bone marrow and get rid of the tumor cells, we heal this bone marrow. This, I do not have these ideas anymore.
Yeah. Well, you had mentioned yesterday, or maybe even, no, it was in the first session, that it was attached to kind of youth and optimism.
Right.
And is that the case, that to be optimistic about, say, clinical translational research is attached to a period of time, perhaps a period of time in an individual's life or a period of time in a scientist's training? And that, you know, as you get older, that optimism fades?
No, I do not see that. I think I'm today as enthusiastic as ever looking at nature, you know? And essentially my fascination for life did not diminish over the years. It's different today as it was, but base is the same. Thinking back to my very early experiences in the stuff I told you about doing pediatric oncology and this idea of translational research at that time, I think we were naive, yeah. And on the other side, sometimes you may need that. Do not know.
Yeah.
It's a long time ago.
Do you have any clinical responsibilities here?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Okay. I would not do that.
Okay. And I guess to return a little bit to funding and things like that. Yesterday we talked about scientific creativity and pretty much science is an intellectual endeavor. And that publication and grant writing was just cleanup work. But what role does, you know, the energy and time it takes to write grants and to get publications and to get the right kind of publications play? in, you know, your daily life?
It's in phases, you know. For example, in the moment, I'm in a grant writing phase. And I cannot do benchwork. So I'm a little bit more annoyed in the moment as I normally would be. And I'm also, look, what I would prefer instead of staying tomorrow at home and working on my application, I would like to come in and start a knockout experiment, which I have to postpone now to the middle of next month. And but look, that is what I have to do. And the thing is, grant writing is also an exercise for me in thinking through what do I have and where can it lead to. And this helps, you know. So going back to this white sheet of paper is helpful sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And look, I have to do it. Okay. I even enjoy it sometimes if I have enough time. And this is one of the things, I never will write a grant application anymore in 6 weeks or so. I start 3 months before and sit on it, have after 6 weeks my first draft, let it sit, come back. Then it's a good experience. If it's done in a rush, look, then I have difficulties with English, Look, here I'm different than Lani. Lani can write a thing in 2 weeks. It sounds great. It reads great. Yeah. But I could not do it. And it would not be me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, where do you see your research going in, say, the next 10 years?
Oh, in the next 10 years. In the next 2 years.
Okay.
In the next 2 years, we should be able to characterize the way retroretinoids are produced. We should be able to determine whether they are really important in biology by knocking the corresponding enzymes out. So this will be exciting in the next 2-3 years in the retroretinoid field. This soluble cyclase, this could go really in multiple directions. If it's it has a huge potential in it could be, I'm convinced it has to do with sperm development, and it may be that it could go in direction male contraception, which would be great, but it also could go in a direction that it may be involved in diabetes. And to work these pathways out should be fun. And also there are some biochemical problems behind this molecule, which I'm really looking forward to look into. For example, this is a molecule, what I purified, the protein is 50,000 Dalton. The cDNA predicts that the molecule is 180,000. So how does it come from the 180 to the 50? Is this physiological or not? This is fun, you know, to do that. And this is stuff which I think is, if nothing new is happening, I think my lab should be busy for another 4 or 5 years. And long term after that, look, it's evolution and revolution. It could be that we simply evolutionary new questions have to be asked. Or the other thing is that I do something different, something new. Like soluble cyclase happened now in the last 15 months. Yeah, so. And 10 years, you know, in 10 years I will be 52. Then I will have to ask me again, what do I want to do in 10 years? Because I told you, I want to be a park ranger.
Okay. So.
And yeah, look, kids will grow. I do, yeah.
Well, how do you balance? And again, we can maybe fill in some of the chronological gaps because you came to the United States married to your first wife.
Right.
And since then, that marriage ended. You've married and had two kids.
Right.
And how has the way you do science been impacted by responsibilities, family responsibilities, and child rearing?
You know, essentially, since there were really two big changes since I'm here in the state. The first change was when I got my own lab and was there in front of an empty room and had to develop something. And the second change really was Hannes, our first son. And look, science is important to me, yes. However, before Hannes, there were more things to my life than science. And sure, I had periods where I spent 60 hours per week in the lab, but this is with me always on, off, dependent what's needed, you know. But there always was other stuff which was important to me. There music. Look, if I do not go to let's say to the knitting factory during that time twice a month, I was unhappy, you know. If I did not go hiking twice a month, if I did not go for vacation for 3 weeks, I was unhappy. So that was as important as science. And now, with this new change of having our first kid, now we have two, one more important thing in my life happened. And to be honest, if you would ask me what's more important, I think Hannes is more important than science. And another change was now that we moved out of the city. This changed the way I worked. We were living until a few months ago only 5 blocks from here. And essentially, I could lead my life the following way, that I could come in and go whenever I wanted. So I could come in at 5 o'clock in the morning, work for 2 hours, go home, have breakfast, sleep a little bit, come in again and go home, read. Whenever I did not want to see anybody, I went home. And this has changed now. And I miss a little bit this flexibility. Also now for experiments, because many of the experiments I do myself have strange timing. I mean with that is I sometimes should be here, let's say, at 1 o'clock at night. And this is now more difficult to get that together with living outside in Connecticut. However, it still is possible. When we, shortly after we moved, I had period where I had to be in every day, where I had weekends where I had to work through, and it was doable. And it's doable because I think Chantal, my wife, accepts it, knows it, that it's important for me, and additionally she knows that there are other times where I have time. And look, the great thing is of being independent, I can have time. And and I have to play with my kids. And one thing is a little bit stupid. What I mean is, when he was born here, and he was born 1 year after I started this lab. And this was the first years Hannes spent a lot of time in the lab. And it was fun having him here, and he enjoyed it, and he still enjoys it to come to the lab. And he enjoys it to do small experiment, and it's fun to have him around. And I cannot give this to Rike. This is our second one, because it's not so easy. Look, it was easy to come with Hannes for half an hour. For half an hour, it's nice to have Hannes. But to drive in with Rike here, and then to drive out after her attention span is over, it's not doable. So, yeah. I would like that Rike would have a similar experience as Hannes. Hannes is so proud of growing Drosophila, of growing, Now we have to grow crystals at home. Okay.
Well, there's two different areas I want to pursue here. And what difference, how do you think this will influence your children's kind of development and attitudes towards science when Hannes was able to come into the lab and play in the lab, like his dad used to play in the lab, and Frederica does not get that same opportunity?
Oh, I hope that I can give to both of my kids an enthusiasm for life, let's say it that way.
Yeah.
Look, if my kids become scientists, fine. They do not have to.
Mm-hmm.
However, what I would like to that they learn to love nature, you know, and the excitement of nature. Yeah, because really it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And let's hope I bring perhaps this over what I may have gotten from my father, you know. I do not want to bring over my math abilities, but what I would like is that they like nature, you know, and with nature this means also what's here on this earth, you know.
Okay.
Evolution, it's fascinating what's happening.
And you had mentioned before that NIH has to, part of the problems with peer review is that NIH has to serve a variety of interests, and one is to make sure that everything is spread out equitably.
Right.
And address issues like minorities representation and institutional representation. And there is a situation where women and minorities are underrepresented in science.
Right.
And you had mentioned off tape that you have known colleagues that, or a colleague that may not, for malicious reasons, but just may not be able to deal with women in their lab the same as men.
Right.
And how do you see the role of gender, these issues of gender playing out in your lab? Or minorities as well?
No, let's first stay with genders. I think in the moment, I think we have more both grad students I have are women. No, both postdocs are women, and the grad student one woman and one man, so it seems that there's a equality, and I think they like it in the lab. We have a lot of fun. I do not see a problem for women on a graduate level or on a postdoc level, but I see real problems coming the moment the decision comes, should women have kids or not? Look, looking at my own family. My kids are extremely well off because Chantal, she's a genetic counselor, decided only to work for 2 days per week. And under these conditions, it's easy for me too.
Right.
If she would, I think I would have major difficulties if Chantal would also go for full-time, because then our kids would grow up with a babysitter. And this would give me difficulties. And this is a thing which we discuss often in the lab, and we do not have solutions. We really do not have solutions. Because, look, I see it as this old traditional way that then a woman would become, that scientist women do not have families or would not have kids. Come on, that this is not satisfying. I think this is one of the tensions we should be aware of and on which we should really work for the next years. But the models do not exist yet. And it's tough because, is it? Look, I wanted to say that if you want to do science, you have to commit yourself. I think that's only partially true. Now we have to find models where women look, the gender, the male-female problem is also not so a problem in our department. The department chair is a woman, and of the older faculty members, we have out of 7 full professors, 3 are women, so, and some of them are older. And I see a problem here, but it. We have to live with the tension. And now with minorities. Chantal is black. Mm-hmm. My kids are half black. And would my kids need affirmative action? No way. Look, this is extreme tough because I totally understand we need it, and but I see also the negative sides. One example, one of Chantal's brothers-in-law, he is a child of affirmative action and came to Harvard, got to made all his career, very likely with the help of affirmative action, but he hated it. So, because he always had, some of his gut told him, I'm here only due to my color. And this is an awful feeling which should not happen. Look, it's one of these things, big problems, where I do not have a clear-cut answer. And the same, I get always chills when in the MD-PhD program, when we are having 2 piles. And the regular pile and the minority pile. It gives me the chills.
Yeah. Okay, let me pop in a new.